During this period, when I was drifting from door to door, job to job, friend to friend, meal to meal, I did try, nevertheless, to rope off a little space for myself, which might be an anchorage. It was more like a life buoy in the midst of a swift channel. To get within a mile of me was to hear a huge, dolorous bell tolling. Nobody could see the anchorage. It was buried deep in the bottom of the channel. One saw me bobbing up and down on the surface, rocking gently sometimes, or else swinging backwards and forwards agitatedly. What held me down safely was the big, pigeon-holed desk which I put in the parlor. This was the desk which had been in the old man's tailoring establishment for the last 50 years, which had given birth to many bills and many groans, which had housed strange souvenirs in its compartments, and which finally I had filched from him when he was ill and away from the establishment. And now it stood in the middle of the floor in our lugubrious parlor on the third floor of a respectable brownstone house in the dead center of the most respectable neighborhood in Brooklyn. I had to fight a tough battle to install it there, but I insisted that it be there in the midmost midst of the shebang. It was like putting a mastodon in the center of a dentist's office. But since the wife had no friends to visit her, and since my friends didn't give a fuck if it were suspended from the chandelier, I kept it in the parlor, and I put all the extra chairs we had around it in a big circle, and then I sat down comfortably, and I put my feet up on the desk and dreamed of what I would write, if I could write. I had a spittoon alongside of the desk, a big brass one from the same establishment, and I would spit in it now and then to remind myself that it was there. All the pigeonholes were empty, and all the drawers were empty. There wasn't a thing on the desk or in it except a sheet of white paper on which I found it impossible to put so much as a pothook. When I think of the titanic efforts I made to canalize the hot lava which was bubbling inside me, the efforts I repeated thousands of times to bring the funnel into place and capture a word, a phrase, I think inevitably of the men of the old Stone Age. 100,000, 200,000 years, 300,000 years to arrive at the idea of the Paleolith. A phantom struggle, because they weren't dreaming of such a thing as the Paleolith. It came without effort, born of a second, a miracle, you might say, except that everything which happens is miraculous. Things happen, or they don't happen. That's all. Nothing is accomplished by sweat and struggle. Nearly everything which we call life is just insomnia, an agony, because we've lost the habit of falling asleep. We don't know how to let go. We're like a jack-in-the-box perched on top of a spring, and the more we struggle, the harder it is to get back in the box. I think if I had been crazy, I couldn't have hit upon a better scheme to consolidate my anchorage than to install this Neanderthal object in the middle of the parlor. With my feet on the desk, picking up the current, and my spinal column snugly socketed in a thick leather cushion, I was in an ideal relation to the flotsam and jetsam which was whirling about me, and which, because they were crazy and part of the flux, my friends were trying to convince me was life. I remember vividly the first contact with reality that I got through my feet, so to speak. The million words or so which I had written, mind you, well-ordered, well-connected, were as nothing to me, crude ciphers from the old Stone Age, because the contact was through the head, and the head is a useless appendage unless you're anchored in mid-channel, deep in the mud. Everything I had written before was museum stuff, and most writing is still museum stuff, and that's why it doesn't catch fire, doesn't inflame the world. I was only a mouthpiece for the ancestral race which was talking through me. Even my dreams were not authentic, not bona fide Henry Miller dreams. To sit still and think one thought which would come up out of me, out of the life buoy, was a Herculean task. I didn't lack thoughts, nor words, nor the power of expression. I lacked something much more important, the lever which would shut off the juice. The bloody machine wouldn't stop. That was the difficulty. I was not only in the middle of the current, but the current was running through me, and I had no control over it whatever. I remember the day I brought the machine to a dead stop, and how the other mechanism, the one that was signed with my own initials, and which I had made with my own hands and my own blood, slowly began to function. I had gone to the theater nearby to see a vaudeville show. It was the matinee, and I had a ticket for the balcony. Standing on line in the lobby, I already experienced a strange feeling of consistency. It was as though I were coagulating, becoming a recognizable, consistent mass of jelly. It was like the ultimate stage in the healing of a wound. I was at the height of normality, which is a very abnormal condition. Cholera might come and blow its foul breath in my mouth. It wouldn't matter. I might bend over and kiss the ulcers of a leprous hand, and no harm could possibly come to me. There was not just a balance in this constant warfare between health and disease, which is all that most of us may hope for, but there was a plus integer in the blood, which meant that, for a few moments at least, disease was completely routed. If one had the wisdom to take root in such a moment, one would never again be ill, or unhappy, or even die. But to leap to this conclusion is to make a jump which would take one back further than the old Stone Age. At that moment, I wasn't even dreaming of taking root. I was experiencing, for the first time in my life, the meaning of the miraculous. I was so amazed when I heard my own cogs meshing that I was willing to die then and there for the privilege of the experience. What happened was this. As I passed the doorman holding the torn stub in my hand, the lights were dimmed and the curtain went up. I stood a moment, slightly dazed by the sudden darkness. As the curtain slowly rose, I had the feeling that throughout the ages, man had always been mysteriously stilled by this brief moment which preludes the spectacle. I could feel the curtain rising in man. And immediately, I also realized that this was a symbol which was being presented to him endlessly in his sleep, and that if he had been awake, the players would never have taken the stage, but he, man, would have mounted the boards. I didn't think this thought. It was a realization, as I say, and so simple and overwhelmingly clear was it that the machine stopped dead instantly, and I was standing in my own presence, bathed in a luminous reality. I turned my eyes away from the stage and beheld the marble staircase, which I should take to go to my seat in the balcony. I saw a man slowly mounting the steps, his hand laid across the balustrade. The man could have been myself, the old self, which had been sleepwalking ever since I was born. My eye didn't take in the entire staircase, just the few steps which the man had climbed, or was climbing in the moment that I took it all in. The man never reached the top of the stairs, and his hand was never removed from the marble balustrade. I felt the curtain descend, and for another few moments I was behind the scenes, moving amidst the sets, like the property man suddenly roused from his sleep and not sure whether he is still dreaming or looking at a dream which is being enacted on the stage. It was as fresh and green, as strangely new as the bread and cheese lands which the Biddenden maidens saw every day of their long life joined at the hips. I saw only that which was alive. The rest faded out in a penumbra. And it was in order to keep the world alive that I rushed home without waiting to see the performance, and sat down to describe the little patch of staircase which is imperishable. It was just about this time that the Dadaists were in full swing, to be followed shortly by the Surrealists. I never heard of either group until some 10 years later. I never read a French book, and I never had a French idea. I was perhaps the unique Dadaist in America, and I didn't know it. I might just as well have been living in the jungles of the Amazon for all the contact I had with the outside world. Nobody understood what I was writing about, or why I wrote that way. I was so lucid that they said I was daffy. I was describing the New World, unfortunately, a little too soon because it had not yet been discovered, and nobody could be persuaded that it existed. It was an ovarian world, still hidden away in the fallopian tubes. Naturally, nothing was clearly formulated. There was only the faint suggestion of a backbone visible, and certainly no arms or legs, no hair, no nails, no teeth. Sex was the last thing to be dreamed of. It was the world of Kronos and his ovicular progeny. It was the world of the iota, each iota being indispensable, frighteningly logical, and absolutely unpredictable. There was no such thing as a thing, because the concept thing was missing. I say it was a new world I was describing, but like the new world which Columbus discovered, it turned out to be a far older world than any we have known. I saw beneath the superficial physiognomy of skin and bone the indestructible world which man has always carried within him. It was neither old nor new, really. but the eternally true world, which changes from moment to moment. Everything I looked at was palimpsest, and there was no layer of writing too strange for me to decipher. When my companions left me of an evening, I would often sit down and write to my friends, the Australian bushmen, or the mound builders of the Mississippi Valley, or to the Igorotes in the Philippines. I had to write English, naturally, because it was the only language I spoke, but between my language and the telegraphic code employed by my bosom friends, there was a world of difference. Any primitive man would have understood me. Any man of archaic epics would have understood me. Only those about me, that is to say, a continent of 100 million people, failed to understand my language. To write intelligibly for them, I would have been obliged, first of all, to kill something. Secondly, to arrest time. I had just made the realization that life is indestructible, and that there is no such thing as time, only the present. Did they expect me to deny a truth which it had taken me all my life to catch a glimpse of? They most certainly did. The one thing they did not want to hear about was that life is indestructible. Was not their precious new world reared on the destruction of the innocent, on rape and plunder and torture and devastation? Both continents had been violated. Both continents had been stripped and plundered of all that was precious in things. No greater humiliation, it seems to me, was meted out to any man than to Montezuma. No race was ever more ruthlessly wiped out than the American Indian. No land was ever raped in the foul and bloody way that California was raped by the gold diggers. I blush to think of our origins. Our hands are steeped in blood and crime. And there is no let-up to the slaughter and the pillage, as I discovered at first hand, traveling throughout the length and breadth of the land. Down to the closest friend, every man is a potential murderer. Often it wasn't necessary to bring out the gun, or the lasso, or the branding iron. They had found subtler and more devilish ways of torturing and killing their own. For me, the most excruciating agony was to have the word annihilated before it had even left my mouth. I learned by bitter experience to hold my tongue. I learned to sit in silence and even smile when actually I was foaming at the mouth. I learned to shake hands and say how do you do to all these innocent-looking fiends who were only waiting for me to sit down in order to suck my blood. How was it possible, when I sat down in the parlor at my prehistoric desk, to use this code language of rape and murder? I was alone in this great hemisphere of violence, but I was not alone as far as the human race was concerned. I was lonely amidst a world of things lit up by phosphorescent flashes of cruelty. I was delirious with an energy which could not be unleashed except in the service of death and futility. I could not begin with a full statement. It would have meant the straitjacket or the electric chair. I was like a man who had been too long incarcerated in a dungeon. I had to feel my way slowly, falteringly, lest I stumble and be run over. I had to accustom myself gradually to the penalties which freedom involves. I had to grow a new epidermis which would protect me from this burning light in the sky. The ovarian world is the product of a life rhythm. The moment a child is born, it becomes part of a world in which there is not only the life rhythm, but the death rhythm. The frantic desire to live at any cost, is not a result of the life rhythm in us, but of the death rhythm. There is not only no need to keep alive at any price, but, if life is undesirable, it is absolutely wrong. This keeping oneself alive, out of a blind urge to defeat death, is in itself a means of sowing death. Everyone who has not fully accepted life, who is not incrementing life, is helping to fill the world with death. To make the simplest gesture with the hand can convey the utmost sense of life. A word spoken with the whole being can give life. Activity in itself means nothing. It is often a sign of death. By simple external pressure, by force of surroundings and example, by the very climate which activity engenders, one can become part of a monstrous death machine, such as America, for example. What does a dynamo know of life? Of peace, of reality. What does any individual American dynamo know of the wisdom and energy, of the life abundant and eternal possessed by a ragged beggar sitting under a tree in the act of meditation? What is energy? What is life? One has only to read the stupid twaddle of the scientific and philosophic textbooks to realize how less than nothing is the wisdom of these energetic Americans. Listen, they had me on the run, these crazy horsepower fiends. In order to break their insane rhythm, their death rhythm, I had to resort to a wavelength which, until I found the proper sustenance in my own bowels, would at least nullify the rhythm they had set up. Certainly I did not need this grotesque, cumbersome, antediluvian desk which I had installed in the parlor. Certainly I didn't need 12 empty chairs placed around it in a semicircle. I needed only elbow room in which to write, and a 13th chair which would take me out of the zodiac they were using and put me in a heaven beyond heaven. But when you drive a man almost crazy, and when, to his own surprise perhaps, he finds that he still has some resistance, some powers of his own, then you are apt to find such a man acting very much like a primitive being. Such a man is apt not only to become stubborn and dogged, but superstitious, a believer in magic and a practicer of magic. Such a man is beyond religion. It is his religiousness he is suffering from. Such a man becomes a monomaniac, bent on doing one thing only, and that is to break the evil spell which has been put upon him. Such a man is beyond throwing bombs, beyond revolt. He wants to stop reacting, whether inertly or ferociously. This man, of all men on earth, wants the act to be a manifestation of life. If, in the realization of his terrible need, he begins to act regressively, to become unsocial, to stammer and stutter, to prove so utterly unadapted as to be incapable of earning a living, know that this man has found his way back to the womb and source of life, and that tomorrow, instead of the contemptible object of ridicule which you have made of him, he will stand forth as a man in his own right, and all the powers of the world will be of no avail against him. Out of the crude cipher with which he communicates from his prehistoric desk with the archaic men of the world, a new language builds up which cuts through the death language of the day like wireless through a storm. There is no magic in this wavelength any more than there is magic in the womb. Men are lonely and out of communication with one another because all their inventions speak only of death. Death is the automaton which rules the world of activity. Death is silent because it has no mouth. Death has never expressed anything. Death is wonderful, too, after life. Only one like myself who has opened his mouth and spoken, only one who has said yes, 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 and again yes, can open wide his arms to death and know no fear. Death as a reward, yes. Death as a result of fulfillment, yes. Death as a crown and shield, yes. But not death from the roots, isolating men, making them bitter and fearful and lonely, giving them fruitless energy, filling them with a will which can only say no. The first word any man writes when he has found himself, his own rhythm, which is the life rhythm, is yes. Everything he writes thereafter is yes, 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 yes in a thousand million ways. No dynamo, no matter how huge, not even a dynamo of 100 million dead souls, can combat one man saying yes. The war was on, and men were being slaughtered. 1 million, 2 million, 5 million, 10 million, 20 million, finally 100 million, then 1 billion, everybody, man, woman, and child, down to the last one. No, they were shouting. No, they shall not pass. And yet everybody passed. Everybody got a free pass, whether he shouted yes or no. In the midst of this triumphant demonstration of spiritually destructive osmosis, I sat with my feet planted on the big desk, trying to communicate with Zeus, the father of Atlantis, and with his lost progeny, ignorant of the fact that Apollinaire was to die the day before the armistice in a military hospital, ignorant of the fact that in his new writing he had penned these indelible lines: "Be forbearing when you compare us with those who were the perfection of order. We who everywhere seek adventure, we are not your enemies. We would give you vast and strange domains where flowering mystery waits for him would pluck it." Ignorant that in this same poem he had also written, "Have compassion on us who are always fighting on the frontiers of the boundless future. Compassion for our errors, compassion for our sins. I was ignorant of the fact that there were men then living who went by the outlandish names of Blaise Cendrars, Jacques Vacher, Louis Aragon, Tristan Tzara, René Crevel, Henri de Montelan, André Breton, Max Ernst, George Gross. Ignorant of the fact that on July 14, 1916, at the Saal Vague in Zurich, the first Dada Manifesto had been proclaimed. Manifesto by Monsieur Antipyrene. That in this strange document it was stated, Dada is life without slippers or parallel, severe necessity without discipline or morality, and we spit on humanity. Ignorant of the fact that the Dada Manifesto of 1918 contained these lines, I am writing a manifesto and I want nothing, yet I say certain things, and I am against manifestos as a matter of principle, as I am also against principles. I write this manifesto to show that one may perform opposed actions together in a single fresh respiration. I am against action, for continual contradiction, for affirmation also. I am neither for nor against, and I do not explain, for I hate good sense. There is a literature which does not reach the voracious mass, the work of creators, sprung from a real necessity on the part of the author and for himself. Consciousness of a supreme egotism where the stars waste away. Each page must explode, either with the profoundly serious and heavy, the whirlwind, dizziness, the new, the eternal, with the overwhelming hoax, with an enthusiasm for principles, or with the mode of typography. On the one hand, a staggering, fleeing world, affianced to the jingle bells of the infernal gamut. On the other hand, new beings. 32 years later, and I am still saying yes. Yes, Monsieur Antipyrene. Yes, Monsieur Tristan Bustanabi Tzara. Yes, Monsieur Max Ernst Gebert. Yes, Monsieur René Crevel, now that you are dead by suicide, yes, the world is crazy. You were right. Yes, Monsieur Blaise Cendrars, you were right to kill. Was it the day of the armistice that you brought out your little book, J'ai tué? Yes, keep on, my lads, humanity. Yes, Jacques Vacher, quite right. Art ought to be something funny and a trifle boring. Yes, my dear dead Vacher, how right you were, and how funny, and how boring and touching and tender and true. It is the essence of symbols to be symbolic. Say it again from the other world. Have you a megaphone up there? Have you found all the arms and legs that were blown off during the melee? Can you put them together again? Do you remember the meeting at Nantes in 1916 with André Breton? Did you celebrate the birth of hysteria together? Had he told you, Breton, that there was only the marvelous and nothing but the marvelous, and that the marvelous is always marvelous, and isn't it marvelous to hear it again, even though your ears are stopped? I want to include here, before passing on, a little portrait of you, by Emile Bouvier, for the benefit of my Brooklyn friends, who may not have recognized me then, but who will now, I am sure. He was not all crazy, and could explain his conduct when occasion required. His actions, nonetheless, were as disconcerting as Jarry's worst eccentricities. For example, he was barely out of hospital when he hired himself out as a stevedore, and he thereafter passed his afternoons in unloading coal on the quays along the Loire. In the evening, on the other hand, he would make the rounds of the cafes and cinemas, dressed in the height of fashion and with many variations of costume. What was more, in time of war, he would strut forth sometimes in the uniform of a lieutenant of hussars, sometimes in that of an English officer, of an aviator, or of a surgeon. In civil life he was quite as free and easy, thinking nothing of introducing Breton, under the name of André Saumon, while he took unto himself, but quite without vanity, the most wonderful titles and adventures. He never said good morning, nor good evening, nor goodbye, and never took any notice of letters, except those from his mother, when he had to ask for money. He did not recognize his best friends from one day to another. Do you recognize me, lads? Just a Brooklyn boy, communicating with the red-haired albinos of the Zuni region. Making ready, with feet on the desk, to write, strong works, works forever incomprehensible, as my dead comrades were promising. These strong works Would you recognize them if you saw them? Do you know that of the millions who were killed, not one death was necessary to produce the strong work? New beings, yes. We have need of new beings still. We can do without the telephone, without the automobile, without the high-class bombers, but we can't do without new beings. If Atlantis was submerged beneath the sea, if the Sphinx and the pyramids remain an eternal riddle, it is because there were no more new beings being born. Stop the machine a moment. Flashback. Flashback to 1914, to the Kaiser, sitting on his horse. Keep him sitting there a moment with his withered arm clutching the bridle rein. Look at his mustache. Look at his haughty air of pride and arrogance. Look at his cannon fodder lined up in strictest discipline, all ready to obey the word, to get shot, to get disemboweled, to be burned in quicklime. Hold it a moment now, and look at the other side. The defenders of our great and glorious civilization, the men who will war to end war. Change their clothes, change their uniforms, change horses, change flags, change terrain. My, is that the Kaiser I see on a white horse? Are those the terrible Huns? And where is Big Bertha? Oh, I see. I thought it was pointing toward Notre Dame. Humanity, me lads, humanity always marching in the van. And the strong works we were speaking of? Where are the strong works? Call up the Western Union and dispatch a messenger fleet of foot, not a cripple or an octogenarian, but a young one. Ask him to find the great work and bring it back. We need it. We have a brand new museum, ready, waiting to house it, and cellophane and the Dewey Decimal System to file it. All we need is the name of the author. Even if he has no name, even if it is an anonymous work, we won't kick. Even if it has a little mustard gas in it, we won't mind. Bring it back, dead or alive. There's a $25,000 reward for the man who fetches it. And if they tell you that these things had to be, that things could not have happened otherwise, that France did her best, and Germany her best, and that little Liberia and little Ecuador and all the other allies also did their best, and that since the war everybody has been doing his best to patch things up or to forget, tell them that their best is not good enough. That we don't want to hear any more this logic of doing the best one can. Tell them we don't want the best of a bad bargain. We don't believe in bargains, good or bad, nor in war memorials. We don't want to hear about the logic of events or any kind of logic. Je ne parle pas logique, said Montalin. Je parle générosité. I don't think you heard it very well, since it was in French. I'll repeat it for you, in the Queen's own language. I'm not talking logic. I'm talking generosity. That's bad English, as the Queen herself might speak it, but it's clear. Generosity. Do you hear? You never practice it, any of you, either in peace or in war. You don't know the meaning of the word. You think to supply guns and ammunition to the winning side is generosity. You think sending Red Cross nurses to the front or the Salvation Army is generosity. You think a bonus 20 years too late is generosity. You think a little pension and a wheelchair is generosity. You think if you give a man his old job back, it's generosity. You don't know what the fucking word means, you bastards. To be generous is to say yes before the man even opens his mouth. To say yes, you have to first be a surrealist or a Dadaist because you have understood what it means to say no. You can even say yes and no at the same time, provided you do more than is expected of you. Be a stevedore in the daytime and a Beau Brummel in the nighttime. Wear any uniform so long as it's not yours. When you write your mother, ask her to cough up a little dough so that you may have a clean rag to wipe your ass with. Don't be disturbed if you see your neighbor going after his wife with a knife. He probably has good reason to go after her, and if he kills her, you may be sure he had the satisfaction of knowing why he did it. If you're trying to improve your mind, stop it. There's no improving the mind. Look to your heart and gizzard. The brain is in the heart. Ah, yes, if I had known then that these birds existed, Cendrars, Vacher, Gross, Ernst, Apollinaire, if I had known that then, if I had known that in their own way they were thinking exactly the same things as I was, I think I'd have blown up. Yes, I think I'd have gone off like a bomb. But I was ignorant. Ignorant of the fact that almost 50 years previously, a crazy Jew in South America had given birth to such startlingly marvelous phrases as, "Doubt's duck with the vermouth lips," or, "I have seen a fig eat an onager," that about the same time a Frenchman who was only a boy was saying, "Find flowers that are chairs. My hunger is the black air's bits. His heart, amber and spunk." Maybe at the same time or thereabouts, while Jarry was saying, "In eating the sound of moths," and Apollinaire repeating after him, "Near a gentleman swallowing himself," and Breton murmuring softly, "Night's petals move uninterruptedly," perhaps "In the air beautiful and black," which the lone Jew had found under the Southern Cross, another man, also lonely and exiled and of Spanish origin, was preparing to put down on paper these memorable words: "I seek, all in all, to console myself for my exile from eternity, for that unearthing, destiero, which I am fond of referring to as my unheavening. At present, I think that the best way to write this novel is to tell how it should be written. It is the novel of the novel, the creation of creation, or God of God, Deus de Deo." Had I known he was going to add this which follows, I would surely have gone off like a bomb. By being crazy is understood losing one's reason. Reason, but not the truth, for there are madmen who speak truths while others keep silent. Speaking of these things, speaking of the war and the war dead, I cannot refrain from mentioning that some 20 years later I ran across this, in French, by a Frenchman. "O miracles of miracles! Il faut le dire, il y a des cadavres que je ne respecte qu'à moitié." Yes, yes, and again yes. Oh, let us do some rash thing, for the sheer pleasure of it. Let us do something live and magnificent, even if destructive. Said the mad cobbler, "All things are generated out of the grand mystery and proceed out of one degree into another. Whatever goes forward in its degree, the same receives no abominate." Everywhere in all times the same Ovarian world announcing itself. Yet also, parallel with these announcements, these prophecies, these gynecological manifestos, parallel and contemporaneous with them, new totem poles, new taboos, new war dances. While into the air so black and beautiful the brothers of man, the poets, the diggers of the future, were spitting their magic lines in this same time, O profound and perplexing riddle, other men were saying, "Won't you please come and take a job in our ammunition factory? We promise you the highest wages, the most sanitary and hygienic conditions. The work is so easy that even a child could do it. And if you had a sister, a wife, a mother, an aunt, as long as she could manipulate her hands, as long as she could prove that she had no bad habits, you were invited to bring her or them along to the ammunition works. If you were shy of soiling your hands, they would explain to you very gently and intelligently just how these delicate mechanisms operated, what they did when they exploded, and why you must not waste even your garbage because, et ipso facto e pluribus unum." The thing that impressed me, going the rounds in search of work, was not so much that they made me vomit every day, assuming I had been lucky enough to put something into my guts, but that they always demanded to know if you were of good habits, if you were steady, if you were sober, if you were industrious, if you had ever worked before, and if not, why not? Even the garbage, which I had gotten the job of collecting for the municipality, was precious to them, the killers. Standing knee-deep in the muck, the lowest of the low, a coolie, an outcast, still I was part of the death racket. I tried reading the Inferno at night, but it was in English, and English is no language for a Catholic work. "Whatever enters in itself into its selfhood, viz. Into its own lubette." Lubette! If I had had a word like that to conjure with then, how peacefully I might have gone about my garbage collecting. How sweet in the night when Dante is out of reach and the hands smell of muck and slime. To take unto oneself this word which in the Dutch means lust, and in Latin lubitum, or the divine beneplacitum. Standing knee-deep in the garbage, I said one day what Meister Eckhart is reported to have said long ago: "I truly have need of God, but God has need of me too." There was a job waiting for me in the slaughterhouse, a nice little job of sorting entrails, but I couldn't raise the fare to get to Chicago. I remained in Brooklyn. in my own palace of entrails, and turned round and round on the plinth of the labyrinth. I remained at home seeking the germinal vesicle, the dragon castle on the floor of the sea, the heavenly heart, the field of the square inch, the house of the square foot, the dark pass, the space of former heaven. I remained locked in, a prisoner of Forculus, god of the door, of Cardia, god of the hinge, and of Lamentius, god of the threshold. I spoke only with their sisters, the three goddesses called Fear, Pallor, and Fever. I saw no Asian luxury, as had St. Augustine, or as he imagined he had. Nor did I see the two twins born, so near together that the second held the first by the heel. But I saw a street called Myrtle Avenue, which runs from Borough Hall to Fresh Pond Road, and down this street no saint ever walked, else it would have crumbled. Down this street no miracle ever passed, nor any poet, nor any species of human genius, nor did any flower ever grow there, nor did the sun strike it squarely, nor did the ram ever wash it. For the genuine inferno, which I had to postpone for 20 years, I give you Myrtle Avenue, one of the innumerable bridle paths ridden by iron monsters which lead to the heart of America's emptiness. If you have only seen Essen, or Manchester, or Chicago, or Levallois-Perret, or Glasgow, or Hoboken, or Canarsie, or Bayonne, you have seen nothing of the magnificent emptiness of progress and enlightenment. Dear reader, you must see Myrtle Avenue before you die, if only to realize how far into the future Dante saw. You must believe me that on this street, neither in the houses which line it, nor the cobblestones which pave it, nor the elevated structure which cuts it atwain, neither in any creature that bears a name and lives thereon, neither in any animal, bird, or insect passing through it to slaughter, or already slaughtered, is there hope of lubet, sublimate, or abominate. It is a street not of sorrow, for sorrow would be human and recognizable, but of sheer emptiness. It is emptier than the most extinct volcano, emptier than a vacuum, emptier than the word God in the mouth of an unbeliever. I said I did not know a word of French then, and it is true, but I was just on the brink of making a great discovery, a discovery which would compensate for the emptiness of Myrtle Avenue and the whole American continent. I had almost reached the shore of that great French ocean which goes by the name of Elifor, an ocean which the French themselves had hardly navigated, and which they had mistaken, it seems, for an inland sea. Reading him even in such a withered language as English has become, I could see that this man who had described the glory of the human race on his cuff was Father Zeus of Atlantis, whom I had been searching for. An ocean, I called him, but he was also a world symphony. He was the first musician the French have produced. He was exalted and controlled, an anomaly. A Gallic Beethoven, a great physician of the soul, a giant lightning rod. He was also a sunflower turning with the sun, always drinking in the light, always radiant and blazing with vitality. He was neither an optimist nor a pessimist, any more than one can say that the ocean is beneficent or malevolent. He was a believer in the human race. He added a cubit to the race by giving it back its dignity, its strength, its need of creation. He saw everything as creation, as solar joy. He didn't record it in orderly fashion. He recorded it musically. He was indifferent to the fact that the French have a tin ear. He was orchestrating for the whole world simultaneously. What was my amazement then, when some years later I arrived in France, to find that there were no monuments erected to him, no streets named after him. Worse, during 8 whole years, I never once heard a Frenchman mention his name. He had to die in order to be put in the pantheon of French deities, and how sickly must they look, his deific contemporaries, in the presence of this radiant sun. If he had not been a physician, and thus permitted to earn a livelihood, what might not have happened to him? Perhaps another able hand for the garbage trucks. The man who made the Egyptian frescoes come alive in all their flaming colors, this man could just as well have starved to death, for all the public cared. But he was an ocean, and the critics drowned in this ocean, and the editors, and the publishers, and the public, too. It will take eons for him to dry up, to evaporate. it will take about as long as for the French to acquire a musical ear. If there had been no music, I would have gone to the madhouse like Nijinsky. It was just about this time that they discovered that Nijinsky was mad. He had been found giving his money away to the poor, always a bad sign. My mind was filled with wonderful treasures, my taste was sharp and exigent, my muscles were in excellent condition, my appetite was strong, my wind sound. I had nothing to do except to improve myself, and I was going crazy with the improvements I made every day. Even if there were a job for me to fill, I couldn't accept it, because what I needed was not work, but a life more abundant. I couldn't waste time being a teacher, a lawyer, a physician, a politician, or anything else that society had to offer. It was easier to accept menial jobs, because it left my mind free. After I was fired from the garbage trucks, I remember taking up with an evangelist who seemed to have great confidence in me. I was a sort of usher, collector, and private secretary. He brought to my attention the whole world of Indian philosophy. Evenings when I was free, I would meet with my friends at the home of Ed Bowery's, who lived in an aristocratic section of Brooklyn. Ed Bowery's was an eccentric pianist who couldn't read a note. He had a bosom pal called George Neumiller, with whom he often played duets. Of the dozen or so who congregated at Ed Bowery's home, nearly every one of us could play the piano. We were all between 21 and 25 at the time. We never brought any women along, and we hardly ever mentioned the subject of woman during these sessions. We had plenty of beer to drink and a whole big house at our disposal, for it was in the summertime, when his folks were away, that we held our gatherings. Though there were a dozen other homes like this which I could speak of, I mention Ed Bowery's place because it was typical of something I have never encountered elsewhere in the world. Neither Ed Bowery's himself nor any of his friends suspected the sort of books I was reading then, nor the things which were occupying my mind. When I blew in, I was greeted enthusiastically as a clown. It was expected of me to start things going. There were about four pianos scattered throughout the big house, to say nothing of the celesta, the organ, guitars, mandolins, fiddles, and whatnot. Ed Bowery's was a nut, a very affable, sympathetic, and generous one, too. The sandwiches were always of the best, the beer plentiful, and if you wanted to stay the night, he could fix you up on a divan just as pretty as you liked. Coming down the street, a big, wide street, somnolent, luxurious, a street altogether out of the world, I could hear the tinkle of the piano in the big parlor on the first floor. The windows were wide open, and as I got into range, I could see Al Berger or Connie Grimm sprawling in their big easy chairs, their feet on the windowsill, and big beer mugs in their hands. Probably George Neumiller was at the piano, improvising, his shirt peeled off and a big cigar in his mouth. They were talking and laughing while George fooled around, searching for an opening. Soon as he hit a theme, he would call for Ed, and Ed would sit beside him, studying it out in his unprofessional way, then suddenly pouncing on the keys and giving tit for tat. Maybe when I'd walk in, somebody would be trying to stand on his hands in the next room. There were three big rooms on the first floor which opened one onto the other, and back of them was a garden, an enormous garden, with flowers, fruit trees, grapevines, statues, fountains, and everything. Sometimes when it was too hot, they brought the celesta or the little organ into the garden, and a keg of beer, naturally, and we'd sit around in the dark, laughing and singing, until the neighbors forced us to stop. Sometimes the music was going on all through the house at once, on every floor. It was really crazy then, intoxicating, and if there had been women around, it would have spoiled it. Sometimes it was like watching an endurance contest, Ed Bowery's and George Neumiller at the grand piano, each trying to wear the other out, changing places without stopping, crossing hands, sometimes falling away to plain chopsticks, sometimes going like a Wurlitzer. And always something to laugh about, all the time. Nobody asked what you did, what you thought about, and so forth. When you arrived at Ed Bowery's place, you checked your identification marks. Nobody gave a fuck what size hat you wore, or how much you paid for it. It was entertainment from the word go, and the sandwiches and the drinks were on the house. And when things got going, three or four pianos at once, the celesta, the organ, the mandolins, the guitars, beer running through the halls, the mantelpieces full of sandwiches and cigars, a breeze coming through from the garden, George Neumiller stripped to the waist and modulating like a fiend. It was better than any show I've ever seen put on, and it didn't cost a cent. In fact, with the dressing and undressing that went on, I always came away with a little extra change and a pocketful of good cigars. I never saw any of them between times, only Monday nights throughout the summer, when Ed held open house. Standing in the garden listening to the din, I could scarcely believe that it was the same city, and if I had ever opened my trap and exposed my guts, it would have been all over. Not one of these bozos amounted to anything, as the world reckons. They were just good eggs, children, fellows who liked music and who liked a good time. They liked it so much that sometimes we had to call the ambulance. Like the night Al Berger twisted his knee while showing us one of his stunts. Everybody so happy, so full of music, so lit up that it took him an hour to persuade us he was really hurt. We try to carry him to a hospital, but it's too far away, and besides, it's such a good joke that we drop him now and then, and that makes him yell like a maniac. So finally we telephone for help from a police box, and the ambulance comes and the patrol wagon, too. They take Al to the hospital, and the rest of us to the Huskow. And on the way we sing at the top of our lungs, and after we're bailed out, we're still feeling good, and the cops are feeling good, too, and so we all adjourn to the basement, where there's a cracked piano, and we go on singing and playing. All this is like some period B.C. in history, which ends not because there's a war, but because even a joint like Ed Bowery's is not immune to the poison seeping in from the periphery. Because every street is becoming a Myrtle Avenue. Because emptiness is filling the whole continent, from the Atlantic to the Pacific. Because, after a certain time, you can't enter a single house throughout the length and breadth of the land and find a man standing on his hands, singing. It just ain't done anymore. And there ain't two pianos going at once anywhere, nor are there two men anywhere willing to play all night, just for the fun of it. Two men who can play like Ed Bowery's and George Neumiller are hired by the radio or the movies, and only a thimbleful of their talent is used, and the rest is thrown into the garbage can. Nobody knows, judging from public spectacles, what talent is disposable in the great American continent. Later on, and that's why I used to sit around on doorsteps in Tin Pan Alley, I would while away the afternoons listening to the professionals mugging it out. That was good, too, but it was different. There was no fun in it. It was a perpetual rehearsal to bring in dollars and cents. Any man in America who had an ounce of humor in him was saving it up to put himself across. There were some wonderful nuts among them, too, men I'll never forget. Men who left no name behind them, and they were the best we produced. I remember an anonymous performer on the Keith circuit who was probably the craziest man in America, and perhaps he got $50 a week for it. Three times a day, every day in the week, he came out and held the audience spellbound. He didn't have an act, he just improvised. He never repeated his jokes or his stunts. He gave himself prodigally, and I don't think he was a hop fiend either. He was one of those guys who are born in the corn crakes, and the energy and the joy in him was so fierce that nothing could contain it. He could play any instrument and dance any step, and he could invent a story on the spot and string it out till the bell rang. He was not only satisfied to do his own act, but he would help the others out. He would stand in the wings and wait for the right moment to break into the other guy's act. He was the whole show. And it was a show that contained more therapy than the whole arsenal of modern science. They ought to have paid a man like this the wages which the President of the United States receives. They ought to sack the President of the United States and the whole Supreme Court and set up a man like this as ruler. This man could cure any disease on the calendar. He was the kind of guy, moreover, as would do it for nothing if you asked him to. This is the type of man which empties the insane asylums. He doesn't propose a cure. He makes everybody crazy. Between this solution and a perpetual state of war, which is civilization, there is only one other way out, and that is the road we will all take eventually, because everything else is doomed to failure. The type that represents this one and only way bears a head with six faces and eight eyes, The head is a revolving lighthouse, and instead of a triple crown at the top, as there might well be, there is a hole which ventilates what few brains there are. There is very little brain, as I say, because there is very little baggage to carry about, because living in full consciousness, the gray matter passes off into light. This is the only type of man one can place above the comedian. He neither laughs nor weeps. He is beyond suffering. We don't recognize him yet because he is too close to us, right under the skin, as a matter of fact. When the comedian catches us in the guts, this man, whose name might be God, I suppose, if he had to use a name, speaks up. When the whole human race is rocking with laughter, laughing so hard that it hurts, I mean, everybody then has his foot on the path. In that moment, everybody can just as well be God as anything else. In that moment, you have the annihilation of dual, triple, quadruple, and multiple consciousness, which is what makes the gray matter coil up in dead folds at the top of the skull. At that moment, you can really feel the hole in the top of the head. You know that you once had an eye there, and that this eye was capable of taking in everything at once. The eye is gone now, but when you laugh until the tears flow and your belly aches, you are really opening the skylight and ventilating the brains. Nobody can persuade you at that moment to take a gun and kill your enemy. Neither can anybody persuade you to open a fat tome containing the metaphysical truths of the world and read it. If you know what freedom means, absolute freedom, and not a relative freedom, then you must recognize that this is the nearest to it you will ever get. If I am against the condition of the world, it is not because I am a moralist. It is because I want to laugh more. I don't say that God is one grand laugh. I say that you've got to laugh hard before you can get anywhere near God. My whole aim in life is to get near to God, that is, to get nearer to myself. That's why it doesn't matter to me what road I take. But music is very important. Music is a tonic for the pineal gland. Music isn't Bach or Beethoven. Music is the can opener of the soul. It makes you terribly quiet inside, makes you aware that there's a roof to your being. The stabbing horror of life is not contained in calamities and disasters, because these things wake one up, and one gets very familiar and intimate with them, and finally they become tame again. No, it is more like being in a hotel room in Hoboken, let us say, and just enough money in one's pocket for another meal. You are in a city that you never expect to be in again, and you have only to pass the night in your hotel room, but it takes all the courage and pluck you possess to stay in that room. There must be a good reason why certain cities, certain places, inspire such loathing and dread. There must be some kind of perpetual murder going on in these places. The people are of the same race as you. They go about their business as people do anywhere. They build the same sort of house, no better, no worse. They have the same system of education, the same currency, the same newspapers. And yet they are absolutely different from the other people you know. And the whole atmosphere is different, and the rhythm is different, and the tension is different. It's almost like looking at yourself in another incarnation. You know with a most disturbing certitude that what governs life is not money, not politics, not religion, not training, not race, not language, not customs, but something else. Something you're trying to throttle all the time, and which is really throttling you, because otherwise you wouldn't be terrified all of a sudden and wonder how you were going to escape. Some cities you don't even have to pass a night in, just an hour or two is enough to unnerve you. I think of Bayonne that way. I came on it in the night with a few addresses that had been given me. I had a briefcase under my arm with a prospectus of the Encyclopedia Britannica. I was supposed to go under cover of dark and sell the bloody encyclopedia to some poor devils who wanted to improve themselves. If I had been dropped off at Helsingfors, I couldn't have felt more ill at ease than walking the streets of Bayonne. It wasn't an American city to me. It wasn't a city at all, but a huge octopus wriggling in the dark. The first door I came to looked so forbidding, I didn't even bother to knock. I went like that to several addresses before I could summon the courage to knock. The first face I took a look at frightened the shit out of me. I don't mean timidity or embarrassment. I mean fear. It was the face of a hod carrier, an ignorant Mick who would as lief fell you with an axe as spit in your eye. I pretended I had the wrong name and hurried on to the next address. Each time the door opened, I saw another monster. And then I came at last to a poor simp who really wanted to improve himself, and that broke me down. I felt truly ashamed of myself, of my country, my race, my epoch. I had a devil of a time persuading him not to buy the damned encyclopedia. He asked me innocently what then had brought me to his home, and without a minute's hesitation, I told him an astounding lie, a lie which was later to prove a great truth. I told him I was only pretending to sell the encyclopedia in order to meet people and write about them. That interested him enormously, even more than the encyclopedia. He wanted to know what I would write about him, if I could say. It's taken me 20 years to answer that question, but here it is. If you would still like to know, John Doe, of the city of Bayonne, this is it. I owe you a great deal, because after that lie I told you, I left your house, and I tore up the prospectus furnished me by the Encyclopedia Britannica, and I threw it in the gutter. I said to myself, I will never again go to people under false pretenses, even if it is to give them the Holy Bible. I will never again sell anything, even if I have to starve. I am going home now, and I will sit down and really write about people. And if anybody knocks at my door to sell me something, I will invite him in and say, why are you doing this? And if he says it is because he has to make a living, I will offer him what money I have and beg him once again to think what he is doing. I want to prevent as many men as possible from pretending that they have to do this or that because they must earn a living. It is not true. One can starve to death. It is much better. Every man who voluntarily starves to death jams another cog in the automatic process. I would rather see a man take a gun and kill his neighbor in order to get the food he needs than keep up the automatic process by pretending that he has to earn a living. That's what I want to say, Mr. John Doe. I pass on. Not the stabbing horror of disaster and calamity, I say, but the automatic throwback. The stark panorama of the soul's atavistic struggle. A bridge in North Carolina, near the Tennessee border. Coming out of lush tobacco fields, low cabins everywhere, and the smell of fresh wood burning. The day passed in a thick lake of waving green. Hardly a soul in sight. Then suddenly a clearing. And I'm over a big gulch, spanned by a rickety wooden bridge. This is the end of the world. How in God's name I got here, and why I'm here, I don't know. How am I going to eat? And if I ate the biggest meal imaginable, I would still be sad, frightfully sad. I don't know where to go from here. This bridge is the end of me, the end of my known world. This bridge is insanity. There is no reason why it should stand there, and no reason why people should cross it. I refuse to budge another step. I balk at crossing that crazy bridge. Nearby is a low wall, which I lie against, trying to think what to do and where to go. I realize quietly what a terribly civilized person I am, the need I have for people, conversation, books, theater, music, cafes, drinks, and so forth. It's terrible to be civilized, because when you come to the end of the world, you have nothing to support the terror of loneliness. To be civilized is to have complicated needs, and a man, when he is full-blown, shouldn't need a thing. All day I have been moving through tobacco fields and growing more and more uneasy. What have I to do with all this tobacco? What am I heading into? People everywhere are producing crops and goods for other people, and I am like a ghost sliding between all this unintelligible activity. I want to find some kind of work, but I don't want to be a part of this thing, this infernal automatic process. I pass through a town, and I look at the newspaper telling what is happening in that town and its environs. It seems to me that nothing is happening, that the clock has stopped, but that these poor devils are unaware of it. I have a strong intuition, moreover, that there is murder in the air. I can smell it. A few days back, I passed the imaginary line which divides the north from the south. I wasn't aware of it until a darkie came along driving a team. When he gets alongside of me, he stands up in his seat and doffs his hat most respectfully. He had snow-white hair and a face of great dignity. That made me feel horrible. It made me realize that there are still slaves. this man had to tip his hat to me, because I was of the white race, whereas I should have tipped my hat to him. I should have saluted him as a survivor of all the vile tortures the white men have inflicted on the black. I should have tipped my hat first to let him know that I am not part of this system, that I am begging forgiveness for all my white brethren who are too ignorant and cruel to make an honest, overt gesture. Today I feel their eyes on me all the time. They watch from behind doors, from behind trees, all very quiet, very peaceful, seemingly. Nigger never say nothing. Nigger he hum all time. White man think nigger learn his place. Nigger learn nothing. Nigger wait. Nigger watch everything white man do. Nigger no say nothing. No sir. No siree. But just the same, the nigger is killing the white man off. Every time the nigger looks at a white man, he's putting a dagger through him. It's not the heat. It's not the bookworm. It's not the bad crops that's killing the South off. It's the nigger. The nigger is giving off a poison, whether he means to or not. The South is coked and doped with nigger poison. Pass on. Sitting outside a barber shop by the James River. I'll be here just 10 minutes while I take a load off my feet. There's a hotel and a few stores opposite me. It all tails off quickly, ends like it began, for no reason. From the bottom of my soul, I pity the poor devils who are born and die here. There is no earthly reason why this place should exist. There is no reason why anybody should cross the street and get himself a shave and haircut or even a sirloin steak. Men, buy yourselves a gun and kill each other off. Wipe this street out of my mind forever. It hasn't an ounce of meaning in it. The same day, after nightfall, still plugging on, digging deeper and deeper into the South, I'm coming away from a little town by a short road leading to the highway. Suddenly I hear footsteps behind me, and soon a young man passes me on the trot, breathing heavily, and cursing with all his might. I stand there a moment, wondering what it's all about. I hear another man coming on the trot. He's an older man, and he's carrying a gun. He breathes fairly easy, and not a word out of his trap. Just as he comes in view, the moon breaks through the clouds, and I catch a good look at his face. He's a manhunter. I stand back as the others come up behind him. I'm trembling with fear. It's the sheriff, I hear a man say, and he's going to get him. Horrible. I move on toward the highway, waiting to hear the shot that will end it all. I hear nothing, just this heavy breathing of the young man and the quick, eager steps of the mob following behind the sheriff. Just as I get near the main road, a man steps out of the darkness and comes over to me very quietly. "Where are you going, son?" he says, quiet-like and almost tenderly. I stammer out something about the next town. "Better stay right here, son," he says. I didn't say another word. I let him take me back into town and hand me over like a thief. I lay on the floor with about 50 other blokes. I had a marvelous sexual dream, which ended with the guillotine. I plug on. It's just as hard to go back as to go forward. I don't have the feeling of being an American citizen anymore. The part of America I came from, where I had some rights, where I felt free, is so far behind me that it's beginning to get fuzzy in my memory. I feel as though someone's got a gun against my back all the time. "Keep moving," is all I seem to hear. If a man talks to me, I try not to seem too intelligent. I try to pretend that I am vitally interested in the crops, in the weather, in the elections. If I stand and stop, they look at me, whites and blacks, they look me through and through, as though I were juicy and edible. I've got to walk another 1,000 miles or so as though I had a deep purpose, as though I were really going somewhere. I've got to look sort of grateful, too, that nobody has yet taken a fancy to plug me. It's depressing and exhilarating at the same time. You're a marked man, and yet nobody pulls the trigger. They let you walk unmolested right into the Gulf of Mexico, where you can drown yourself. Yes, sir, I reached the Gulf of Mexico, and I walked right into it and drowned myself. I did it gratis. When they fished the corpse out, they found it was marked FOB, Myrtle Avenue, Brooklyn. It was returned, COD. When I was asked later why I had killed myself, I could only think to say, because I wanted to electrify the cosmos. I meant by that a very simple thing. The Delaware, Lackawanna, and Western had been electrified, the Seaboard Airline had been electrified, but the soul of man was still in the covered wagon stage. I was born in the midst of civilization, and I accepted it very naturally. What else was there to do? But the joke was that nobody else was taking it seriously. I was the only man in the community who was truly civilized. There was no place for me, as yet. And yet the books I read, the music I heard, assured me that there were other men in the world like myself. I had to go and drown myself in the Gulf of Mexico in order to have an excuse for continuing this pseudo-civilized existence. I had to de-louse myself of my spiritual body, as it were. When I woke up to the fact that as far as the scheme of things goes, I was less than dirt, I really became quite happy. I quickly lost all sense of responsibility, and if it weren't for the fact that my friends got tired of lending me money, I might have gone on indefinitely, pissing the time away. The world was like a museum to me. I saw nothing to do but eat into this marvelous chocolate layer cake which the men of the past had dumped on our hands. It annoyed everybody to see the way I enjoyed myself. Their logic was that art was very beautiful, oh yes, indeed, but you must work for a living, and then you will find that you are too tired to think about art. But it was when I threatened to add a layer or two on my own account to this marvelous chocolate layer cake that they blew up on me. That was the finishing touch. That meant I was definitely crazy. First, I was considered to be a useless member of society. Then, for a time, I was found to be a reckless, happy-go-lucky corpse with a tremendous appetite. Now, I had become crazy. Listen, you bastard, you find yourself a job. We're through with you. In a way, it was refreshing, this change of front. I could feel the wind blowing through the corridors. At least we were no longer becalmed. It was war, and as a corpse, I was just fresh enough to have a little fight left in me. War is revivifying. War stirs the blood. It was in the midst of the World War, which I had forgotten about, that this change of heart took place. I got myself married overnight, to demonstrate to all and sundry that I didn't give a fuck one way or the other. Getting married was okay in their minds. I remember that, on the strength of the announcement, I raised $5 immediately. My friend McGregor paid for the license and even paid for the shave and haircut, which he insisted I go through with in order to get married. They said you couldn't go without being shaved. I didn't see any reason why you couldn't get hitched up without a shave and haircut, but since it didn't cost me anything, I submitted to it. It was interesting to see how everybody was eager to contribute something to our maintenance. All of a sudden, just because I had shown a bit of sense, they came flocking around us. And couldn't they do this, and couldn't they do that for us? Of course, the assumption was that now I would surely be going to work. Now I would see that life is serious business. It never occurred to them that I might let my wife work for me. I was really very decent to her in the beginning. I wasn't a slave driver. All I asked for was car fare to hunt for the mythical job, and a little pin money for cigarettes, movies, etc. The important things, such as books, music albums, gramophones, porterhouse steaks, and such like, I found we could get on credit, now that we were married. The installment plan had been invented expressly for guys like me. The down payment was easy, the rest I left to Providence. One has to live, they were always saying. Now, by God, that's what I said to myself. One has to live. Live first, and pay afterwards. If I saw an overcoat I liked, I went in and bought it. I would buy it a little in advance of the season, too, to show that I was a serious-minded chap. Shit, I was a married man, and soon I would probably be a father. I was entitled to a winter overcoat at least, no? And when I had the overcoat, I thought of stout shoes to go with it, a pair of thick cordovans, such as I had wanted all my life, but never could afford. And when it grew bitter cold, and I was out looking for the job, I used to get terribly hungry sometimes. It's really healthy going out like that, day after day, prowling about the city in rain and snow and wind and hail, and so now and then I'd drop into a cozy tavern and order myself a juicy porterhouse steak with onions and French-fried potatoes. I took out life insurance and accident insurance, too. It's important when you're married to do things like that, so they told me. Supposing I should drop dead one day, what then? I remember the guy telling me that. in order to clinch his argument. I had already told him I would sign up, but he must have forgotten it. I had said, yes, immediately, out of force of habit, but as I say, he had evidently overlooked it. Or else it was against the code to sign a man up until you had delivered the full sales talk. Anyway, I was just getting ready to ask him how long it would take before you could make a loan on the policy when he popped the hypothetical question. Supposing you should drop dead one day, what then? I guess he thought I was a little off my nut, the way I laughed at that. I laughed until the tears rolled down my face. Finally, he said, I don't see that I said anything so funny. Well, I said, getting serious for a moment, take a good look at me. Now tell me, do you think I'm the sort of fellow who gives a fuck what happens once he's dead? He was quite taken aback by this, apparently, because the next thing he said was, I don't think that's a very ethical attitude, Mr. Miller. I'm sure you wouldn't want your wife to... Listen, I said, supposing I told you I don't give a fuck what happens to my wife when I die. What then? And since this seemed to injure his ethical susceptibilities still more, I added for good measure, as far as I'm concerned, you don't have to pay the insurance when I croak. I'm only doing this to make you feel good. I'm trying to help the world along, don't you see? You've got to live, haven't you? Well, I'm just putting a little food in your mouth, that's all. If you have anything else to sell, trot it out. I buy anything that sounds good. I'm a buyer, not a seller. I like to see people looking happy. That's why I buy things. Now listen, how much did you say that would come to per week? 57 cents? Fine. What's 57 cents? You see that piano? That comes to about 39 cents a week, I think. Look around you. Everything you see costs so much a week. You say, if I should die, what then? Do you suppose I'm going to die on all these people? That would be a hell of a joke. No, I'd rather have them come and take the things away, if I can't pay for them, I mean. He was fidgeting about, and there was a rather glassy stare in his eye, I thought. Excuse me, I said, interrupting myself, but wouldn't you like to have a little drink, to wet the policy? He said he thought not, but I insisted, and besides, I hadn't signed the papers yet, and my urine would have to be examined and approved of, and all sorts of stamps and seals would have to be affixed. I knew all that crap by heart, so I thought we might have a little snifter first, and in that way protract the serious business, because honestly, buying insurance or buying anything was a real pleasure to me, and gave me the feeling that I was just like every other citizen, a man, what, and not a monkey. So I got out a bottle of sherry, which is all that was allowed me, and I poured out a generous glassful for him, thinking to myself that it was fine to see the sherry going because maybe the next time they'd buy something better for me. I used to sell insurance, too, once upon a time, I said, raising the glass to my lips. Sure, I can sell anything. The only thing is, I'm lazy. Take a day like today. Isn't it nicer to be indoors, reading a book or listening to the phonograph? Why should I go out and hustle for an insurance company? If I had been working today, you wouldn't have caught me in. Isn't that so? No, I think it's better to take it easy and help people out when they come along. Like with you, for instance, it's much nicer to buy things than to sell them, don't you think? If you have the money, of course. In this house, we don't need much money. As I was saying, the piano comes to about 39 cents a week, or 42 maybe, and the... Excuse me, Mr. Miller... he interrupted. But don't you think we ought to get down to signing these papers? Why, of course, I said cheerfully. Did you bring them all with you? Which one do you think we ought to sign first? By the way, you haven't got a fountain pen you'd like to sell me, have you? Just sign right here, he said, pretending to ignore my remarks. And here. That's it. Now then, Mr. Miller, I think I'll say good day, and you'll be hearing from the company in a few days. Better make it sooner, I remarked, leading him to the door. Because I might change my mind and commit suicide. Why, of course, why, yes, Mr. Miller, certainly we will. Good day now, good day.